Our help is in the name of the Lord,
who made heaven and earth.
Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writer Series, and we're continuing our reading of St. John Cassian's Conferences, and we're making our way through the book. It's sort of exciting. We're on beginning Conference 19 tonight, and so we only have about 200 more pages left in the book, but with our track record of reading one page a night, it might take us a little 200. Bit longer to get through it. But it picks up nicely with what we were discussing the last, maybe 5 weeks. Cassian, if you remember, in talking to the elder, was making the distinction between the various kinds of monks within the desert, some that were good and some that were not so good, and making the distinctions of what made the Cenobites and the Anchorites in particular the most solid of the four or five that were mentioned. But this discussion has been also a backdrop for a greater discussion of particular vices that monks would face within their lives, as well as the cure to those vices, the virtues that would be sought to overcome them. And that's what continues in this Conference 19. We'll be looking in particular at the life of the Cenobites and the Anchorites and the goal or the end that they are each seeking. What would be the great virtue that each of them would be seeking in their form of life. And we'll see, I think, why the distinction's important. We've already touched upon it a little bit, and why it would be so important in particular to embrace the life of the Cenobite, to really be formed in overcoming the vices and growing in the passions before one would seek to the greater or higher things, which is theoria, or contemplation of God, that one would only seek that out, especially in the deeper solitude of the desert when one has achieved a certain level of purity of heart. Entering more deeply into the desert without a community there or elder to guide and direct you could be a dangerous thing. And so to be well-formed in mind and heart after many years of living in the Cenobium would be very important. And we've discussed why this would be important to us in our thinking about the spiritual life today, that often I think the spiritual life is presented in such a way that people would seek shortcuts to a deeper mystical kind of experience of God. And so forms of prayer can often be put forward to individuals without much attention, perhaps given to the disciplined life, the ascetical life, in particular, or the ordering of the passions. And as we see in the Desert Fathers, this is seen as a very dangerous kind of thing. And there's a kind of not-so-subtle delusion in it either to think that, you know, we could enter into this deep intimacy with the Lord without really seeking to set aside our sin. And, you know, certainly God can bestow the gift upon any individual that he would desire, but certainly being pure of heart, really having sought to embrace the grace of God in our lives to grow in virtue would open us up most fully for that kind of experience. And I think this is what we'll be discussing here in the next few nights in this conference. Okay. So we're picking up with the editor's introduction on page 663. The 19th conference follows neatly on the 18th. The first of the two had begun to discuss the difference between the Cenobitic and the Anchoritic professions. And the present one continues that discussion in a somewhat more systematic fashion. But it opens with the account of an incident that Cassian and Germanus witnessed while attending an anniversary service at a Cenobium under the direction of a certain Abba Paul. The reason for the placement of this brief narrative, which offers the reader an example of astonishing patience, is somewhat unclear. Perhaps Cassian is resuming one of the major themes of the second half of the previous conference, namely that of patience, or anticipating that same theme as it will appear toward the end of the present conference. In any event, the incident in question suggests to Cassian an unfavorable comparison with the example of patients that he had seen in his own monastery in Syria. So we've already been presented in the last couple of weeks with this extraordinary virtue of patience in Paphnutius, and we'll be given a similar example of it in this conference. And I don't think it's all that unclear. I think it's the elders showing us that the height of the virtue that's needed before one would enter into the more solitary life, that one would really have to set aside ego, self-esteem, and have perfected humility and patience to be able to enter in to the depths of the desert and to seek that solitude where God can be found. Because it's there in that deep silence that the things that perhaps we have not worked to heal are going to come forward the most. It's the things that come from the depths of our unconscious, the depths of our hearts that will come forward as we enter into that silence. And I think that's why we avoid it so much. Whether it's in the chapel or in our rooms, we tend to distract ourselves because it's often in that silence that the kind of anger that we have towards others or certain situations, the deep frustrations that we carry with us, often will come forward, whereas it's much easier to distract ourselves and listening to music, watching television or movies or the like. Okay. Of the identity of Abba Paul, who speaks to the two friends in this conference, we cannot be sure. There is a John, disciple of Paul, who figures in the Apothegmata Patrum, that is the sayings of the fathers, but despite the fact that John, or Cassian's John, lived in Paul's synobium, and that the Pauls of both the Apothegmata and the conferences had a penchant for hitting people, the former strikes John a blow in order to humiliate him, just as the latter gives an unknown monk a resounding slap. It is likely that the John and Paul of the Apothegmata were solitaries, and hence not the same as Cassian's two Cenobites. The dialogue begins when Cassian and Germanus question why John, who had lived as a solitary for 20 years, would have left the life for the Cenobitic. John's immediate answer is to praise the anchoritic profession while briefly alluding to some of its dangers. After mentioning the ecstasies into which he would habitually fall when dwelling alone, which he does in order to leave his hearers in no doubt as to the grandeur of which the anchoritic life is capable, he proceeds to measure it against the Cenobitic life. If the former is marked by the possibilities of rapture and ardent prayer, the latter is ideally characterized by an evangelical disregard for the morrow and by submission to the elders. On the negative side, anchorites were tempted to pride, vainglory, arrogance, and they run the risk of being preoccupied by food and possessions. More than that, they are besieged by visitors and they must make visits in return. If the negative aspect of Cenobitism is a certain diminution of that purity of heart, whose importance was stressed at the very start of the conferences, this is amply compensated, at least in John's opinion, by the observance of the gospel precept to give no thought to the morrow. So in our own thinking, we might be a little confused about this. We might think that the anchorite would have less concerns about the morrow, that he would be simply focused upon God in his prayer. But things are flipped around here for us a little bit. We're being told that the common life actually provides a kind of freedom in that regard, because you are living in a community with others. There's the work is spread out among the members, and so the monastery can become self-sufficient over time, and then a kind of regular pattern of the life can begin for them. And so they might not have the deep solitude of the desert, but they begin to function in such a way that if they don't have to worry about tomorrow. They're able to simply take care of the needs of the present day, not by even storing it up, but just by engaging in the discipline of the monastic life. Whereas the anchorite, surprisingly, has to be concerned about how he's going to feed himself. He has nobody to take care of him. And so the danger of the anchorite would be to think, well, I need to work harder to store up more things for myself, or I have to seek out benefactors in order to be able to provide that for myself. So he can become actually overly concerned about how he's going to take care of himself a week, a month, a couple of months down the road. And it can become no small distraction for him and pull him off of the ultimate goal that he's seeking in the end anyways, which is this life of deeper contemplation, distractions, freeing the mind and the heart from all thoughts of anything about God. Well, if you're constantly thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner tomorrow, that's, you know, certainly going to get in the way of it. And so we have a unique situation here where this Abba John was living in, is it Abba John? Yes. Living in the desert as an anchorite for 20 years and had lived it well, but he returns to the Cenobium. And we'll find out why when we go through the text, but he returns there because it's a safer form of life. You know, that you don't have those concerns for the morrow, but also there are certain sins that are easier to overcome in the discipline of the common life. When you're out on your own, sometimes they're harder to overcome. And so he saw something in himself that told him to return to the common life even after 20 years of solitude. And so it's an interesting thing. There's this back and forth in this conference. The anchoritic life is held up as the ideal, that this is where we begin to experience the kingdom of God now in the moment, this intimacy with God where there is no obstruction to that whatsoever. So it's held up as the ideal, but we're also shown very clearly why it's dangerous to pursue it except after many years of being proven in the common life. And even then, you know, one might not be rightly suited for it. Okay. Since John is proficient in both the anchoritic and the cenobitic professions, Germanus is moved to ask him what their respective ends are. Perfection in both lives, John replies, is a rare thing. Then in more direct response to the question, he states clearly, the end of the Cenobite is to put to death and to crucify all his desires and, in accordance with the gospel precept, to have no thought for the next day. But the perfection of the hermit is to have a mind bare of all earthly things and, as much as human frailty permits, to unite it thus with Christ. Returning to the matter that he had raised a few moments previously, however, John observes that the most complete perfection lies in the practice of the virtues of both professions. With this, he gives examples of solitaries whose hospitality was such that one would not know whether they were inclined more to the common or to the eremitical life. So there, you know, it's rare, but you can find those who in the Cenobium would be living it so well and had reached such a perfection in overcoming the passions that they began to live this life of deep contemplation, even in the midst of the work of the community. But anchorites who, even when they would receive guest visitors who would be seeking counsel, that they would not be thrown out of themselves or become angry at the disruption to their silence, but treat others with such a loving hospitality that it would be surprising to those who would visit them that there wasn't, the person didn't miss a beat and doesn't seem frustrated by the disturbance. So So we might experience that just practically if we look at our own life, that if we make a decision to set ourselves down for prayer and, you know, we're engaging in it and yet something comes up. And this was Philip Neri's thing, that if the doorbell rings and somebody's seeking a confessor, that one would immediately leave Christ for Christ, that you should not bemoan the loss of that opportunity to spend that time in prayer, that the greater thing there is charity. So we would always retreat to our rooms, the nido, the nest, for prayer when not working, in order to experience that contemplation with God. But as soon as we are called out, as soon as the bell of the porter rings, one would jump, as it were, to respond without hesitation. But you could see where someone might grouse about that. I've been working hard all day, you know, I've heard 50 confessions, I don't need to hear one one more, you know, after a long day. Okay. John's remark that some solitaries cannot bear the interruption of their brother monks or have even left the cenobitic life out of disgust for community causes Germanus to ask whether he and Cassian are ready for an eremitical existence, inasmuch as they left their cenobitic training rather abruptly. The old man's answer is not necessarily encouraging. Those who go into the desert with insufficient maturity will discover that their sinful tendencies may not show themselves exteriorly, but they still disturb their minds. Germanus acknowledges the truth of this and requests John's advice as to a remedy. The remedy, he is told, is to drive out a given vice by replacing it with the opposing virtue. This will mean both imagining difficult and unpleasant situations in which to exercise certain virtues and pursuing such practices as fasting and watching. The result will be the destruction of those vices that should have already been rooted out in the cenobium. Anger in particular will yield to patience. So it's very hard to foster a virtue, you know, if one has left prematurely. There are things certainly that one can do to try to cure it, but trying to cure oneself is a dangerous habit to get into. To diagnose one's own illness, let alone to try to treat it, is foolhardy, both with physical and in spiritual things, spiritual matters. But Germanus wants to know, can the spirit of fornication be handled in the same way? Is it right to imagine lustful situations in order to exercise one's chastity? John responds in the negative. The slightest lustful thought is dangerous and must not be pursued. Nonetheless, those who are perfectly chaste may occasionally test their chastity by vivid imaginings. On this note, which recalls 15:10:3, the present conference concludes. That's sort of an interesting matter, that chastity is unlike some of the other virtues, and the struggle with, you know, thoughts of fornication and things like that are different than struggling with other passions, that there's a natural element, a bodily element, that's rooted in our very desires as human beings. And so it becomes an unwise thing then to rouse what has been tempered through the ascetic disciplines, that this is always one aspect of who we are as human beings, that we have to maintain a constant vigilance until we're in the grave, that we're always human beings, we always have those appetites. So even if we have been really well-formed in our hearts and we guard our thoughts, our imagination, you know, we're not impervious to falls. And so even the advice that in some circumstances a person could do that to test his virtue, I think Abba John here would be in the minority in that regard. I think most of the fathers tend to say never, you know, that in that battle, vigilance is the only practice to be maintained.
Would you happen to know what his reasoning is behind saying, like, just exercise it. Like, people with perfect chastity can do that. Like, it just sounds...
Right, and maybe, yeah, but who's of perfect chastity? I think the... It's probably extraordinarily rare for those in the desert, and the rarity of living in the world would make it even less likely that we would be able to do such a thing. That we're just so constantly surrounded and bombarded with, you know, that which is carnal or sensual, that I think it would be very dangerous. You know, that once one has formed the heart in such a way that we aren't bothered by that so much, then to put ourselves to the test. So these are monks who, you know, have removed themselves from everything and are in the desert. And like those on Mount Athos, you know, there aren't even female animals on, you know, the mountain. And so it's, you know, they have removed themselves from that which would be a temptation. And even then, I mean, you know, they are pretty modest in regards to what they believe we are capable of, human beings. Not because those things are evil, but because there's so much of who we are as a human being, and that we have to respect the power of them. And that's typically what I find myself telling younger people. It's the way of overcoming, or the way of growing in chastity, is not to suddenly begin to treat sexuality as something evil. And one, you know, we have to sort of see the power of it as a bodily and an emotional desire. And in that respect, we then learn not to put ourselves to the test. That we have to embrace a life of deep prayer, guarding of the thoughts, fasting that humbles the body, humbles another appetite. These are all things that respect the power of those desires. Well, these men would have been seasoned and all of that. So perhaps we could imagine a monk, you know, of great virtue, living as an anchorite, testing himself in that regard, you know, to see if there's any weak spot in his spiritual life. But it's hard to imagine that that would apply to anyone living in the world, especially today.
Is that appropriate, though, to kind of put yourself in that situation to see if you have a weak spot? Like, that kind of, especially with chastity, I think it was St. Philip who said, like, the coward is the one who...
Coward is the victor, right.
Yeah, like, so it seems like just... Yeah. Any case.
Well, I kind of feel like when we hear vivid imaginings, we're imagining something like pornographic.
Yeah.
That, I'm guessing, is not what he's talking. I mean, he's literally talking about like imagining that a woman is standing in front of you.
Okay.
Like, these are the kinds of situations that they brought
not
up. Like, I was taking a walk through the desert and a woman crossed my path and I dropped everything and ran the other direction at like 30 miles an hour. So like, I don't think what he's saying is that. I think it's like, what would I do if a woman happened to appear in the desert?
Yeah. Okay. Like, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
What are you doing here?
Yeah, exactly. Would I look at her? Like, I mean, really. Like... Those are the kinds of stories we found.
Would I help her cross the stream?
That's right.
No,
yeah.
I can understand.
There goes
this
the
sort
neighborhood.
I think, like you said, like the word vividly, like is.
Yeah.
Yeah, they weren't talking about conjuring up fantasies.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I think, what Ren said.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense.
Okay. Although Cassian manifests an increasing sympathy for the Cenobitic life in this conference, he goes so far as to say that Cenobitic virtues are necessary complements to anchoritic ones. The anchoritic life is still clearly the ideal and the next step after the Cenobitism. So true is this that the four monks who are offered in 1991 as examples of successful combining of both Cenobitic and anchoritic virtues are in fact themselves anchorites. John's own passage from solitude to community is an act of humility on his part, and represents an option for what could be called the safer way. It is noteworthy, finally, that the definition of the end of the Cenobite in 19.8, cited above, does not include any mention of the Cenobites' community, however implicit, even though it is clear from the later passages, especially 19.16, one following, that the community, human society, has no small role to play in Hmong's development. There is indeed nothing essential to prevent the definition of the Cenobite as it stands from forming part of the definition of the hermit. So the hermit would have been one who, you know, engaged in a common life, in a social life. And even the anchorites, as has already been alluded to here, would have had contact with people that, because of the depth of their spiritual life, they would often be sought out for counsel. And it could be a source of frustration for them, and that's why they would often move out further and further in order to maintain it, or not see people who are simply seeking them out of curiosity. It's not that they were, that they completely avoided human contact. Except in some cases, they would even come out of a deep solitude to deal with greater church affairs, that they became so well known for their virtue and their wisdom that if something was afflicting the church, that they would be sought out for their counsel. All right, so we'll move on to the conference, section 1-1 on 669. After a very few days, we were drawn by the desire for further instruction, and we returned in great haste to the Snobium of Abba Paul. Although more than 200 brothers were living there, nonetheless an immense throng of monks from another Snobio as well had come together for the sake of the rite which was taking place then, for the anniversary of the death of a former Abba, who had been in charge of the same Snobium as being observed. We have mentioned this gathering in order to indicate briefly a certain brother's patience, which because of its unwavering gentleness shone out before the entire congregation. For although this work is concerned with something else, namely with our citing the words of Abba John, who left the desert and with the most virtuous humility submitted himself to the Cenobium, we still do not think it at all out of place if, as we believe, those who are eager for great virtue may be edified without much wordiness. As the multitude of monks, then, was sitting in a large open court in separate circles of 12, and one of the brothers was a little late in bringing around the serving dish that he had received, the aforesaid Abba Paul, who was running about anxiously among the crowds of brothers who were waiting on table, saw this and gave him such a slap with his outstretched hand in the sight of all that the sound of his striking palm even echoed in the ears of those who had their backs turned or who were sitting at a distance. But the young man was remarkable for his patience and received this with such a gentle mind that not only did no word fall from his mouth or the slightest murmur move silently on his lips, but even the very modesty and peaceableness of his mouth and his color were not in the least changed. This fact was noteworthy, not only to us, who had recently come from our monastery in Syria and had never seen the virtue of patience so clearly exemplified, but also to all those who were not bereft of corresponding zeal. As a result, a valuable lesson was given even to the most advanced men, because even a paternal correction had not shaken his patience, nor such a multitude of onlookers caused his face so much as to blush. So, you know, these are tough examples, because the thought of humiliating somebody in front of 200 monks, you know, seems, you know, very harsh to us. But the example that is shown is fairly profound, that it's often hard for us to receive, again, a sharp word from somebody, or even sometimes a harsh look. or even no response at all, that they just didn't engage us in the way that we wanted them to, can make us stir with anger, irritation, feel bad, you know, become downcast, despondent. He doesn't like me, she doesn't like me, you know. And here is a monk in the, you know, in front of 200 others who gets a full slap on the face to the point that others hear it, and so hard, but yet doesn't get an angry look on his face, nor does he blush. You know, sometimes just, you know, in enduring something like that, you know, even if we would endure it well, we would show some sign of it. And yet this young monk's heart had been so deeply formed to trust, not only in the virtue, but to trust in the elder, that he could receive something such as this without being moved to confusion or anger or even show any kind of physical response to it. Now, we have to be careful here and not, you know, present this as a model to be practiced, because obviously there could be abuse, and none of us are, you know, like a Saint Philip or one of these holy monks. So it's not being put forward here for us as an example to follow and practice, but I think rather to show us the heights that patience can reach, that by the grace of God, that we can endure things as Christ, and are called to endure them as Christ did. You know, one who was spit upon, had his beard pulled, you know, whipped and crucified, and yet could endure all those things with deep love, even asking for forgiveness of those who had done these things to him. And so here we see a monk so perfected in the virtue that he really does become a model of Christ in that regard. Don't worry, I'm not going to slap you across the face. Although Father Drew did say to bring up the thing about the loo and loo.
Oh, stop.
In lieu of flowers. Oh.
Don't
She's turning red.
That's such a mean thing. I misspelled something on the email I sent out. I never used the word loo.
After ask.
Well, we joked at dinner. We joked at dinner. At least it wasn't spelled in lieu, L-O-O. This could be
in
more
the lieu of flowers. It smells nice.
In lieu of flowers. Okay. Where are we here? Number two?
Number two.
In this synobium, then, we found an old man of great age named John, whose words as well as whose humility, in which he surpassed all other holy ones, we thought should not be passed over in silence. We know that he was especially proficient in this perfection, which, although it is the mother of all the virtues and the most solid foundation of the entire spiritual structure, is completely absent from our own institutes. Hence it is no wonder that we can mount to the heights of these men who are barely content to endure the yoke of submission for 2 years and immediately flee to the arrogance of a harmful freedom, never mind being able to remain under the discipline of the synobium until old age. Yet even for such a short while as that, we seem to be subject to the governance of an elder, not according to a strict rule, but with an eye out for our own freedom of will. So it's a humbling experience for Germanus and Cassian, that, you know, here they are seeing those living the height of perfection within the synobium and who had lived there for decades. And they are seeing a perfection even in a young monk that is extraordinary. And here they are, after living 2 years in their monastery, run off to Egypt to visit, you know, the monks there and the anchorites, and have it in their minds, in their hearts, to live the life of great solitude. And so all of this must have been extraordinarily humbling for them. you know, to imagine themselves as capable of that after witnessing, you know, not just holy anchorites, but those living the common life in a way that they had never experienced, certainly in themselves, but in their own communities. When we had seen this old man in the snowbeam of the aforesaid Abbot Paul, then we first wondered at the man's age and great and the grace with which he had been endowed. Then, with eyes cast down, we began to beseech him to deign to explain to us why he had left the freedom of the desert and that sublime profession wherein a very celebrated reputation had given him precedence over others leading the same life, and chosen to place himself under the yoke of the cenobium. He said that being unequal to the anchorite discipline and unworthy to such heights of perfection, he had returned to the school for juniors in order to see if he could still carry out the institutes that were in keeping with the level of their profession. When our opposition, couched in petition, refused to accept this humble response, he finally began as follows. So he's sort of an oddity for them, you know, because they see the anchoritic life as the ideal. And here was one who had gained this reputation for holy life, returning to what they would have thought was a lesser state. It's like, you know, someone who has a college degree going back saying, well, I really didn't learn enough in high school, so I'm going to go back to, you know, ninth grade and start over again. And so this is what Paul does. Or at least that's what he tries to tell them, and they aren't buying it. He goes on to say, I not only do not reject and deny the anchorite discipline, which you are amazed to see that I've abandoned, but on the contrary, I embrace and esteem it with utter veneration. I'm glad that after having lived 30 years in a cenobium, I passed another 20 in it. Thus I should never, like those who pursued it lukewarmly, be blamed for laziness. But because the purity that I experienced there was occasionally soiled by concern for carnal matters, it seemed more appropriate to return to the cenobium so that the readier perfection of an easier chosen orientation, the one that I took up, might be acquired, and there might be less danger from the humility of a more sublime profession that had been presumed upon. For it is better to be found faithful in keeping little promises than careless in keeping great ones. So I think we can all see the value of this teaching, that, you know, there can be a kind of pride in us when we think about the spiritual life or a romantic notion of the spiritual life. And even when we're beginning, because we're filled with, you know, this sense of ourselves or what God is calling us to, that, you know, we lose the humility that's necessary. Whereas, you know, Abba Paul, you know, could see that the cenobium was the place where he learned what was most important, that there he learned the ABCs of the monastic life, the life of virtue, and there was enough within the anchoritic life to call into question for him that there were weaknesses, you know, fault lines within his heart that he could see, that he might have been living a very virtuous life. I don't think we want to misunderstand the word carnal here. It might be simply that he had concerns that were of more of a worldly nature. Again, sort of what we were talking about earlier, that he was overly focused upon taking care of his immediate and physical needs that made him think, you know, I need to think about returning to the place where I began, and that would actually be the wiser course for me and the safer one, and if I could live that to its perfection, then it actually becomes the better path for me to take. Even though the anchoritic life would have been the ideal, the better life for him and the wiser choice would have been the cenobitic.
Any In the introduction, a word caught my eye. Those is maturity.
Mm-hmm.
Those who go into the desert with insufficient maturity will discover that their sinful tendencies may not show themselves exteriorly, but that they still disturb their minds.
Right.
So, I mean, is that
yeah.
more important?
I think it's very, very important, not only, you know, having entered into the life, but even before entering into it, of really discerning well what one is seeking. And that the religious life, for example, can be sought out prematurely before a person has reached a level of emotional maturity as well as spiritual maturity where they would be able to persevere in the life and endure the rigors of it. That out of excitement or out of a genuine fervor for God, they might seek out that path. But sometimes even against the counsel of their spiritual director or spiritual guide, they would run off to join a monastery. And simply because they weren't prepared for that, then aren't able to endure the disciplines of it, the obedience, you know, the humbling nature of the life. Whereas if they would have waited a few years and continued to deepen their spiritual life, to allow their minds and their hearts to be formed in such a way, and then to grow emotionally, too, that they could endure things without being so humiliated by things that they just couldn't stand it and had to get out, or so irritated and agitated by members of the community that they couldn't stand it and so would leave. So the maturity on both levels, emotional and spiritual, are very important. And you know, sometimes our makeup, you know, emotionally and spiritually, might not make it not possible for us to pursue something like the life of an anchorite. You know, we might have a great desire for God and a desire for holiness, but because of who we are, He wills that we would stay within the cenobitic life or community life. That will always be the path of greater perfection for us. We might not know why, other than the providence of God, you know, that He would set us along a certain path. You were going to follow.
So then how would it apply to lay people?
Well, you know, I think the same thing with, you know, the greatest vocation crisis now is marriage. It's not the religious life. Everybody keeps throwing that out. You know, this vocation crisis among priests and religious. You know, certainly that is true, you know, mostly because of the breakdown of the family and the Catholic culture. But marriage, you know, marriages are really struggling. You know, the percentage of divorce and the number of people who enter into marriage understanding the sacramental nature of it and the reality of which it's, that it reflects, there are very few. And in fact, I can count on two hands the number of people I've married over the course of over 20 years who I really felt were prepared deeply for that and ready to enter into it. And that's a frightening thought. And I think sometimes if you were to ask priests and they were honest with you, a lot of them would say doing marriages can be a desolating kind of experience because often there isn't the freedom even to help as a priest pastorally, because typically you're given 6 months to work with a couple, and often they're swept up in all the other preparations where the anything that has to do with their spiritual or emotional life is very hard to deal with at that point. And there was a point when I was doing marriages early on where I'd say, oh, it must have been 85% that were coming to me were cohabitating. So there was one thing there that was already an impediment to the extent that when they are doing the annulment investigation, it's one of the things that they look for, you know, is the couple living together, because that often breaks down their freedom, you know, because they become bound to each other some financially, emotionally. Often, you know, they're involved in a physical relationship, and so they lose that freedom to really discern clearly. So, you know, if we were to apply this to, say, the lay life, I think it's very applicable to say, you know, that there is this kind of formation that is necessary throughout the course of one's youth in order to prepare them for this extraordinary vocation. And I think we have this tendency to think because marriage is more of a natural good, that it's something that exists within the cult, and the culture has existed throughout history, that, you know, that they're naturally going to learn how to do this based upon being a man and a woman, or their affection for each other, or their, you know, a natural pull there, and that this is going to help them endure in the relationship. And I think what we're seeing that's an illusion, and that it doesn't endure. In fact, we see the huge crisis that exists there. And so I think if we were to take what we're reading here and say, well, there has to be a maturity that exists spiritually and emotionally before one would embrace such a high vocation. And, you know, people sort of joke now that, you know, adolescence reaches into the 30s. You know, people don't mature emotionally. You know, everybody's playing their Xbox or whatever it is, you know, games, video games. You know, that's how they spend their evenings and into their 30s. And you think, okay, those are things kids usually did when they were little and then they grow up. What was I? I went to the funeral home when we were preparing, you know, for my dad, and the Jacques Freivogel, who runs the funeral home, was saying that when his great-grandfather, I think it was, who started in it, he was 16 years old. He worked for another funeral home first. And 16 years old, and you think about, what are we doing at 16? And, you know, he was taking care of, like, the horses that would draw the hearses at that point and stuff. But nonetheless, he was, you know, working at a job. And so had undoubtedly would mature on an emotional level because of the reality and the circumstances of life that required a kind of discipline, you know, that he had to take his life and work seriously. And so what is really going to help prepare lay men and women to enter into the vocation, the sacrament of marriage, unless they are doing all the things that we've been reading about for these last 2 years, that they are seeking to that purity of heart that Cassian puts out as the immediate goal through overcoming the vices and growing in virtue? How can you make the free gift of yourself to another person where there isn't a kind of selfishness or self-seeking, but where you really seek the virtue of the other and the salvation of the other, and can enter into that relationship emotionally and physically and spiritually in this mature fashion? And so, oftentimes when I've been to meetings, you know, with priests and bishops talking about it, there isn't a clue, you know, about that. You know, often it talks about, you know, making it a teachable moment, perhaps, you know, the marriage, as if a sacrament is to be, you know, used in that fashion. You know, there's a kind of intellectual as well as spiritual dishonesty about that, to think that that's how we should approach the sacrament of marriage, and that we're going to give them a good experience of the church, and that that somehow is going to be enough then to, you know, help them enter into the spiritual life more fully. And it doesn't work. And the whole thing of the 6 month period or even a year period, I think, given the realities in our culture now and how people are formed, the broken families that they've come from or what was lacking there, that we really need, and to serve people passionately, to say this is significant. And we need to help bring about a great deal of healing so that there can be that freedom for them to enter into this relationship. We do that for priests. They're screened. And even then, you know, there can be issues that, you know, crop up later because it's not really done well. But there's this often like 6-8 year period, it can go on for a very long time, where, you know, they're evaluated by, you know, professors psychologically, spiritually, you know, the spiritual director, and, you know, so they go through all this through many years to discern whether or not they are to, you know, seek ordination. And the discernment isn't something they're simply doing on their own. It becomes the diocese discerning with that person, or the religious community discerning with that individual. You know, it's not that we do that in an individualistic, isolated kind of way. Once you engage a religious community, for example, it's all of you discerning whether or not you have a vocation. But there's nothing like that for married couples. And, you know, the engage, what is it, the pre-Cana meetings, you know, most people find that very discouraging. I think my sister told me when they had, the woman gave the talk on artificial contraception, she was this grossly, you know, overweight woman smoking cigarettes, saying, talking about the dangers, the medical dangers of using birth control. You know, there was a kind of absurdity to it. And so I think when you read Cassian and others of the Desert Fathers, it's saying that the spiritual life has to be something that's entered in fully. And it involves every aspect of who we are as human beings. And in so far as we pretend to do that or think that our Christian life can be anything else but that, that there's a different holiness for monks and nuns and for lay people, then we're never going to be living the Christian life. Any other thoughts on that? Because it's a good question. You know, how would this apply to the lay life?
One thing is, I've thought a couple times about this, but talking about the kind of brokenness of marriage at this point, it seems like in most Catholic families, like the discussion of, like, for boys, like, of the priesthood just isn't there at all. Like, it's kind of assumed that everyone's going into the married life, and so there's no discernment at all about, like, okay, what goes on there. And it kind of facilitates, I think, a little bit more of a shallow discernment process when you're thinking about, like, a potential husband or wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just wondering, like, how do you build up that culture again of, like, thinking of this as such a serious matter and as a great spiritual matter, in which it's not just assumed. It's more like you have to really focus on what you're capable of, and like finding somebody to discern with you, like you mentioned, like a spiritual director.
Right. Well, I think that's the big question, and you know, we have this tendency, I think, in, you know, the West to want to fix things, you know, and to fix them quickly. And so we create, you know, come up with an idea and try to implement it. And, you know, the whole thing of a new evangelization, you know, that to revitalize the life of the church. And so we'll offer these, you know, 10-week programs within a church, you know, a parish, show these videos and talk about it, and that somehow that's going to, I'm not saying that's not a good thing, but that will be the extent of the new evangelization. And often it is, you know, or there will be some groups, Bible studies and things like that, which we'll find too. But, you know, I think when we look to the East, you know, they see the life in Christ is involving one's whole self, and that, you know, it isn't simply this intellectual affair for us, but rather we're entering into this relationship. And the way that that is expressed is in by entering into the mystery of that liturgically, and also entering into the mystery of our own self as human beings and seeking the healing that only Christ can offer through seeking this purity of heart. And so, you know, our way of addressing it is, I think, doing what maybe the Second Vatican Council did put forward, which is this idea of ressourcement, of going back to the sources of our faith, but not in this superficial fashion, but really going back to look at the essence of what it is to be a Christian. You know, go ahead, yes.
No, I was going to say, you see this being lived out. I know what you're talking about. You see, I know a lot of homeschooling families and work with homeschooling families. And it's interesting, simply, you know, to go back to the source in sort of basic sense, basic Catholic life, where the parents are involved, the family is praying, there's a good spirit in the house, they're attending the liturgy. I think of many boys who, growing up, they see priests normally, and their parents, just contrary to what you're saying, assume that the parents are in the disposition of mind that the child could choose the priesthood, or their child could choose marriage. They're open to both, but leave freedom to the children while exposing them to good family life as well as to religious or. And you can see in these children that they naturally do, and raised in the right circumstances, they are discerning from a very young age whether to be a priest or to be religious. But it seems though that the parents seeking holiness in just the traditional basic ways is really where, rather than an imposed program or a plan or a strategy, that this very hidden, quiet way is maybe the way that it happens successfully.
And I think, you know, this sense that when we look at the Desert Fathers, that life in Christ is everything. So the pursuit of holiness, the pursuit of the kingdom is placed above everything. Theoria, you know, this contemplation is this experience of the fullness of the kingdom. It might be episodic, you know, in terms of that encounter with God in such a radical way, but that's what one is seeking. So seeking to live the life of virtue, to live the gospel in all its fullness, that shapes the contours of our entire life. And I think when we would look at many Christians today, it's hard to say, you know, it would be hard to say for many of us as Christians, priests, religious included, that, you know, that this the relationship with Christ and the pursuit of the life of holiness, of all the things that we've been looking at here over these past years, this is the center of my consciousness. This is what I'm thinking about all the time and what I'm doing. And even if I fail miserably at it, this is what, and it leads, you know, I'm led to repentance and compunction over that, that it's still that's what I'm seeking. And we don't have, like, the culture of the desert that fosters that. We don't have the culture of the church that fosters that, and in a way that perhaps it did in the past in some measure. And so when all of those things have faded away, I think it becomes a pretty bleak picture. So somebody, who's the author recently who brought up the Benedict option? You know, we brought him up once here before. He's a secular writer who actually, well, he, you know, talks about, you know, taking the path of a Saint Benedict, you know, of creating these communities that, you know, are like what we would find among the Cenobites, that, you know, creating communities that would really foster the kind of life and virtue that we would be seeking. And, you know, it might not sound very reasonable, but, you know, I think what we would seek to create with an oratory is something like that. The oratory can be sort of the nucleus of that, but it's all those who are part of the secular oratory who who come here, engage in the faith, support each other in the faith, that really does become that. We don't have to go off to the desert or the country to establish that, but we really have to have, you know, a place where we find that life is centered upon Christ and that there are all the things there necessary to help nourish that. And a community that's going to help support those who are seeking it. Any other thoughts? Okay, where are we in the...
There are four if I mention.
Okay, 671, right?
Yes.
Right. Therefore, if I mention something rather proudly and perhaps even rather freely, I ask that you consider it to be motivated not by the vice of boastfulness, but by a concern for your edification. And because I think that no part of the truth should be withheld from you, who are so eagerly seeking it, you should reckon it to the account of love rather than of boastfulness. For I am of the opinion that some instruction can be given you if I lay humility aside for a short while and tell you in direct fashion the whole truth about my chosen orientation. I am confident that I shall not get a reputation for vainglory with you because of the candor of my words, nor shall I bring upon my own conscience the crime of lying, as it were, for having suppressed the truth. Okay, so that actually brings us to an hour, and that might be a good place to stop, you know, where he's going to go into greater detail with them why he returns to the Cenobium. But nonetheless, I think that's a good start for us, and I don't mind ever spending the time, I think, just, you know, thinking about how this would apply to our life within the world. You know, often I think the desert monks are again sort of presented to us as being sort of archaic and, you know, not speaking to the present day, when I think what we're seeing is just the opposite. You know, that could be the real very source of renewal within the life of the church.
So, okay, so for lay people, married and single, it's not so much that we have to make a choice between, you know, some sort of anchoritic or eremitic life, but it's more kind of the virtues that are found within.
It's the seeking of the purity. It's having a clarity that Cassian puts out at the beginning in the earliest conferences, that understanding our immediate goal is seeking that purity of heart. And that involves the struggle over the years of seeking to overcome our vices and to grow in virtue. And, you know, that we would make every use of every means in order to do that. And that same purity of heart is, you know, required of those living in the world as those living in the monks. Their particular path might be in the desert or in a religious community. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's to be sought within marriage as well. It might radically change the shape of what that looks like from a secular marriage, which it should. I mean, it's supposed to be that which manifests the love of Christ for his bride, the church. You know, that it's a sacrament. It makes present what it signifies. And so a Catholic marriage should be radically different in appearance and lifestyle than secular marriages. So, you know, the way they live their life, the way they pray, the priorities that they have, the way that they raise their children, all these things should be radically different from the secular mindset. We are not meant to enculturate ourselves into the culture, you know, in the sense that we're formed by the culture rather than forming it. But I think the opposite has happened. Any other final thoughts? I'll close there with Our Father. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And
And with your spirit.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Amen. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.